Most of you are still here. This is the part of the, we have a one-day conference, this is the part of the conference in which it's the most, it is very difficult for me to be interesting. And it is very, very difficult for you to be interested. Maybe we ought to meet halfway. I'll try to be half interesting, you try to be half interested, maybe we can make it to the end. I'm serious. And we want to talk about the third part of the DNA, the third topic of gospel DNA. I believe that effective urban churches need to be using gospel renewal dynamics. They need to be they need to have this balanced and flexible and thoughtful approach to culture. Thirdly, they need to be missional. Now, I know what you're going to say. What does missional really mean? Of course, everyone wants to use the word missional, and so perhaps I should give it up. But just like I took the word religion in the very beginning, some of you know, but I sometimes take the word religion, which actually has a pretty broad lexical range. You don't have to use it as negatively as I did, but I filled the word religion with a certain amount of meaning for pedagogical purposes, and said for the discussion's sake, let's define religion in this sort of negative way, works righteousness. So I would like to define missional for you, just for pedagogical purposes, not because I feel that it's a good idea to use the word missional all the time on all of your books or on your websites, because now I do think the way in which people have argued over the word, and some people have tried to brand the word and other people have tried to brand it, so in some ways it doesn't communicate terribly well to the world anymore. But for our purposes, I'd like to talk about being a missional church. And let me define missional. It's more than just being evangelistic. A missional church is geared in every aspect of its life in intense awareness. Every aspect of its life is intensely aware of the fact that it is surrounded by non-Christians of a particular culture. When I listen to the case studies here, the African churches are working in an alien culture, which is Britain, but the white British churches are working in an alien culture. It's becoming increasingly secularized. If you want to go to a part of the world where the broad culture is still semi-Christian, you probably could go to the American South. Flannery O'Connor, the Roman Catholic writer, said that even though she wouldn't call the South a Christian society, she would call it Christ-haunted. Have you ever heard that term? She says the Southern United States is a Christ-haunted society. And what she means by that is that not that it's an overtly Christian society, but rather Christ is overshadows the way in which people think and do things. That's just not true in Britain. That's not true in the Northeastern United States either. So in the South, you can get away with just being an evangelistic church, because the people outside your doors aren't all that different from the people inside culturally, and their thinking isn't that different. And what you need to do in a situation in which the people outside your doors aren't all that different from people inside is you just need to do evangelism. I mean, the people have the basic, you might say, intellectual furniture. They do believe in moral right and wrong. They do, basically, in many cases, they believe in heaven and hell. They believe in, they essentially have a kind of Christian universe in their mind. And what you have to do is make it personal for them. You have to show them what they have to do. And so evangelism, in that case, is taking what they already know and making it personal and bringing it home and calling them to repentance and commitment. But I'm saying we need to become missional. And it's not the same. A missional church, and I tried to define it on the one page here. By the way, in this case, I think I'm actually going to use the handout a little bit more, so you might want to find it. But a missional church gears absolutely every single part of its life, its worship, community, public discourse, preaching, and education, with the presence of non-believers from the culture surrounding in mind. What do I mean by that? All right? Let me give you, this is an overview, then we'll try to drill down into it. It means, first of all, that the missional church's congregation, that the Christians inside, can't look utterly different from the people walking around outside. If culturally you're all completely different, which often, by the way, happens, then you're going to have a lot of trouble reaching your neighborhood. I mean, this is very often happens. I mean, actually, for example, in Harlem, it's a little bit less the case than it used to be, but 20 years ago, Harlem was almost completely poor. But the churches were all middle class. And what had happened was the black middle class had left Harlem as it had become poor and had moved elsewhere. And before the 1950s in America, because of segregation formal in the South and informal in the North, the black middle class and professionals and the poor were all together. But then what happened was because of civil rights, which is a great thing, it enabled the black middle class to disperse from the poor. And so what happened was the people would move out and then they would commute back into the home church, the great historic church, which was in the center of Harlem, that at one time had been a community of mixed class, but it became completely poor. So by the 80s and the 90s, you had these middle class and professional black churches in the midst of poor black communities. And therefore, the people inside did not look at all like the people outside. They weren't like the people outside. And if an outsider came in, they immediately felt a complete disconnect. And therefore, one part of being missional means that the people on the outside, when they look in and they see Christians, they got to be Christians, I mentioned this earlier, that show them what they would look like if they became believers. So they have some idea of what they would look like. So they have some idea of what you're calling them to be. And if the people on the inside are utterly traditional and conservative, everybody outside are completely artsy and avant-garde, then, you know, you're not a missional church. Another is the preaching. Now, again, in some subsequent visit here to London in the next few months as part of the consultation, I want to get back to preaching. So I'll only say this briefly. I believe that it is a mistake, and it's not being missional, to say evangelism happens completely outside the walls and inside the church. When you gather, when we gather on Sundays, we are gathering strictly to teach the saints. We're strictly building up the saints, in which case the messages are very theological, doctrinal, good, but they're also geared almost completely for Christians. They're in the vocabulary of the Christians, and a non-Christian who comes in will be bored at worst, confused at best, I mean, and bored. And there's nothing there for them. I would say that's not a missional church. I think there's no reason why I cannot preach a text that I believe is largely for the edification of believers, but do it in such a way that I expect non-believers to be present and overhear me talking to the believers. A missional preacher is always expecting non-believers from the neighborhood to be present. And even when you're basically speaking to believers, you want to speak to believers so the non-believers hear how Christians deal with their problems and how Christians look at themselves and how Christians repent. Therefore, you have to preach in the vernacular. You know, Protestants used to look down their nose at the Catholics. You say, you know, look at you having these Latin masses. We speak in the people's language. We speak in the people's language. But there's an awful lot of evangelical churches that don't do that. It might as well be a Latin mass. And therefore, a missional preaching is someone who, and I'm not saying that you go to seeker-oriented services so that you're just creating these very, very brief, simple gospel messages and you're starving the saints who come and they don't get edified. I'm not saying that. I'm saying you always preach with the non-believers around in mind. You assume that they're listening through the windows or something like that. And I can tell you this. If you preach, even though they're not there, even though there's 30 people present on a Sunday morning and not a single one of them is a non-believer, you know it because you know every single one of them. You need to preach as if the people in your neighborhood are there. You say, why? Because that's the only way that ever will be there. You know why? Because if a Christian comes and listens to you and says, wow, I'm really being built up here. This is great. I'm going to really learn. That's not good enough. If the Christian comes and says, this is edifying me, but boy, this would get across to my non-Christian friend or neighbor, the Christian gospel in a way that I can't articulate. And I know that this is speaking right to the kinds of questions that these people have. And I want to bring them too. I'm being built up, but I want to bring them too. See, if that begins to happen, you're a missional preacher. Because people can come and come to your church and be very loyal and be built up and be very edified and are growing, but they instinctively know that they couldn't bring a non-Christian family member or a non-Christian neighbor or friend because they would be either confused or bored because it's not missional preaching. You can preach very edificationally, you can preach very theologically, you can preach very doctrinally, but you can do it in a way that you remember that there's, if you preach as if the non-Christian members of your community are there, they'll be brought, even though they're not there the day you do that. But if you preach as if they're not there, because you say, well, they're not there, then they'll never be there. Another aspect of being a missional church is that the discourse in general, I'll get to this in a second, that the way in which people talk about Christianity is connected to the concerns of the people around. Another way in which you're a missional church is that the people of your members are very, very involved in the community. They're not only active inside the church, they're also active in the community. Because they're active in the community, if your members are extremely well known amongst non-Christians in your community, then you've got a missional church. Now, if all these things are true, this is a very long introduction, sorry. This time of day, why be so long-winded? So I know Dick Lucas calls this waggling on the tee. But if you do that, if you preach like that, I mean, in other words, if the church in every regard assumes the presence of non-believers in the community, then you'll find that they'll be brought and they will be there. They'll be everywhere. They'll be in your gathered Sunday times. They'll be in your small groups. They'll be in your, hopefully they won't be in your leadership training. But apart from that, they should be all through your church, all incubating and growing toward Christ through a combination of hearing the word and community. I mean, I just baptized a Jewish woman who became a Christian at Redeemer and she was a poster child for this, you might say. She looked at me and she said, no offense. She said, if I hadn't come and heard your preaching, I probably wouldn't have joined the small group. But you know what? As much as I found the Christianity interesting, an awful lot of what you said just didn't make sense. But I kind of felt like I probably needed to think more about it. In other words, all I did was get her defenses down. And then somebody invited me to a small group. I got into a small group. And in this, the first thing that happened in that small group was there's a young couple ahead of the group. And the husband, who's only in his mid-30s, and the father of four small children and a leader in our church, became deathly ill and almost died. It was about a six-month period in which it looked like he wasn't going to live. And this young woman, was in this small group and watched how that couple processed that, how the young mother faced it with Christ, and was so astounded by their approach. Their poise, their love, their peace. That she said to me, and this is all her testimony. She says, "You know, your gospel preaching was good enough to get me into that group, but it was in the group that I finally figured out what you were talking about." She needed to be in the group for a year, 2 years. She was in the church incubating, and unless you have a church that's it's possible for that to happen, then you're not going to process these folks who are not like folks in the southern United States that are pretty much like you. All you need to do is get them to walk that aisle and pray to receive Christ. But people like this need to be processed over a long period of time. Now, let me give you a couple more ideas now about, having said this, basically, what does it mean to be missional? It means that every part of your church is contextualized for the culture around it. So let's talk about missional. Let's talk about contextual. I'm going to try to take 10 minutes and 10 minutes on that. And then we can take some questions. So to do that, why don't you turn to page in your handout 6. Or the bottom of page 5, excuse me. Let me just give you some ideas about what I mean by being missional. This is going a little deeper. Now, if this is not on there, let me give you 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Let me give you 5. They're not. This is not exactly what you see there. I'll go in and out. Number one, to be a missional church, your people have to have a positive view of your neighborhood and your city. I know that's not on the sheet here. I'm going to add this. When I first got to New York, I got to know a lot of evangelical churches, and I came to realize something, that evangelical churches were havens for people who hated New York. That an awful lot of Christians, when they came to New York because their job brought them there, they hated it. They hated the secularism of it. They hated the debauchery. They hated the immorality. They hated the materialism. They hated the diversity, I'm afraid. They hated the cultural diversity in many cases. And they did their job because, of course, if you work in a law firm in a bank in New York City, then you can go home with that on your resume and you got it made. I'm sure similar things happen here. People come here for a while to work and then they go back to where they came from and it helps them in their careers and so on. So we have all these evangelical Christians who come to New York, but they hated New York. They disliked it tremendously. And they got together and basically their churches were little enclaves of warmth where they could keep themselves warm and fend off the coldness of New York City until they could get out. Well, the problem is that most of the people who really run things in New York are people who like New York. Most of the non-Christians like New York. That's why they came. The Christians came because their job made them come. But an awful lot of other people come because they like it. And a lot of other people come because they have to be there. And there's a number of immigrants and a lot of poor people, actually, and gay people pretty much have to be in a big city. Otherwise, they are ostracized. And so there's a whole lot of other people who come and they love New York. They love the diversity, etc. And if your church has an attitude in it that is sort of anti-city, anti the people around, then you're going to find that nobody shows up except people who don't like it. And those are people who won't be there long. The people who live in the city for a long time are people who like it. And so a positive view of the city, talking up the city, talking positively about the city is actually part of being a missional church. In other words, you actually like your city, you like your neighborhood, you're concerned about it as opposed to just seeing it as all filled with darkness. Number one. Number two, now, discourse in the vernacular. Let me follow what I actually say here. The missional church, here's ABC, the missional church avoids tribal language, stylized prayer language, unnecessary evangelical pious jargon, and archaic language that seeks to take a spiritual tone. Do you know what I'm talking about? I early on in my time at Redeemer, there was a woman who'd become a Christian, and she was a very secular background, and she never prayed in the small group I was in with her. And at one point, I asked her, you know, you should feel free to pray, you know, with everybody else. And she says, I wouldn't know how to do it. It was all this strange, interesting language. She says, it's interesting. All these people that seem just like me, and we talk, and it's really nice. But when they pray, I don't think I know how to use the words. In fact, I don't know what some of the words mean. And when I started listening to the way in which Christians prayed, I suddenly realized, why do they talk like that? Why do they talk to God like that? They don't talk to each other like that. The tribal language, which I think tries to get across a kind of spiritual tone, is it is very possible to be reverent, inspiring. It's very possible to talk with spiritual gravitas and not rely on that. And I think it's crucial if you're going to be a missional church. B, the missional church avoids we-them language, disdainful jokes that mock people of different politics, mocks people of different beliefs, dismissive, disrespectful comments not about those who differ with us. In fact, if non-group believers hear you making snarky, you know what snarky is? I can never tell when I come to another country. You know, dismissive, disdainful, scornful statements not only about certain non-believers or about people of the other political party that other than the one that you favor, but even to talk about other parts of the Christian church that way. You know, making jokes about the other groups like that. That's something that non-Christians say, see, that's what Christianity, it's just dividing us. It's not part of the solution. And besides that, it's not gospel to be dismissive of everybody who's not like you. It's just not, Think about what the gospel means. Think about what the gospel says about you. C, the missional church avoids sentimental, pompous, inspirational talk. Instead, we engage the culture with gentle, self-deprecating but joyful irony that the gospel creates. What I mean by there's a gentle irony that there's a kind of humor that is easy to see that it is an expression of humility. There's some people who are very, very funny, and if you actually analyze it, it's a humor that includes people, and it's because it's self-deprecating. It disarms people because you're taking yourself off the pedestal. And there's another kind of humor in which you're basically scoring points. So I would actually say that there's a gospel form of humor and there's a non-gospel form of humor. And humor is actually quite important, I believe. Lack of humor means self-importance to an increasing number of people. I mean, I know that their cultures are different, and humor is a huge area where cultures differ. However, you're going to find your younger non-Christian people tend to be people who imbibe global popular culture, and global popular culture, I'm afraid, comes from America. And because it comes from America, increasingly you're going to find your younger non-Christian people appreciate humor and irony. But you have to contextualize it, and you've got to bathe it in the gospel. And the only kind of humor and irony that is bathed in the gospel is that which is humble and not zinging and not disdainful. D. The missional church avoids talking as if non-believing people are not present. We've talked about that. And E, unless all the above is done as an outflow of a truly humble, bold gospel change heart, is just spin. So, loving the city. Second, discoursing in the vernacular. Third, enter and retell the culture story with the gospel. This is a subject, unfortunately. I'll talk to you a little bit more about this in a minute. But how do I say this? You remember in 1 Corinthians 1, where Paul makes an amazing statement. He says, the Jews want power, and the Greeks want wisdom. But the cross is what? Weakness to the Jew and foolishness to the Greek. But to the Jews and the Greeks who are being saved, the cross is the true power of God and the true wisdom of God. Now think carefully about what he's just said there. It's extremely interesting. What he was saying was that the cultural narrative of the Jew was what works. Very practical. Very practical. Power. What gets things done. They're not big into speculation. They're not big into philosophy. They want to know how to get things done. Whereas the Greek has a different cultural narrative. They're much more interested in philosophy and wisdom. And they like to do speculation and reflection. And Paul says, on the one hand, the cross challenges the idolatry that the Jew has of power, makes an idol out of power, because the cross is weakness, represents weakness. But on the other hand, the cross also challenges the Greek cultural idolatry of wisdom, because it's foolishness. It's foolish. Jesus didn't come to be a philosopher, and he didn't come to be a political organizer. He came to die on the cross to be a savior. So the Christian gospel, on the one hand, it confronts the two different cultural narratives, right? And yet, Paul goes so far as to say, but to the Jews who are being saved, they begin to realize the cross is the real power of God. And to the Greeks that are being saved, they come to realize the cross is the real wisdom of God. What's going on there? Now, I'm only going to take another 30 seconds on this. Paul didn't preach the gospel exactly the same way to the Jews as to the Greeks. All you got to do is go through the book of Acts and see. The Jews were asking different questions, and they were giving different answers. And Paul had to come to the Jews and say, these questions you're asking, your answers are wrong. Christ is the answer to your questions. But when he comes to the Greeks, he says, you see these questions and you see the answers you're giving? You're wrong. Christ is the answer to your question. But see, if Christ is the answer to the Greek questions, won't be quite exactly the same kind of preaching as Christ the answer to the Jewish question. That just figures. And what you have to be careful about, like, for example, in Britain, you may find very often that white-collar professional people, that their questions aren't the same as blue-collar working-class people. They're not asking the same big questions. And that has to affect the way in which you preach. It has to affect the way in which you talk. If you want to have a church that is more diverse than you, you better be careful. You may be preaching the gospel in a way that's only answering questions that people from one culture is asking, and you're kind of oblivious to it because you live in that culture. Don't ask a fish to tell you anything about water because the fish will say, "What's water?" And don't ask a white-collar person, an African-American once said to me, "You know, the problem with you white people," when a black man starts a sentence like that, you kind of hunker down and you say, "No, what?" The problem with you white people is you don't think you have a culture. And I remember saying, "What do you mean?" And he says, African-American, when you see me doing things, you say, "That's the way black people do it. That's the way black people do it." But when you look at yourself, you say, "That's just the way it's done. That's just reality. In other words, when you do something, you never see it as part of your white culture. You just see it as the right way to do it. You know, you say, "Oh, there's Asians. They do it that way. You know, that's their culture. There's the black culture. There's the Hispanic culture." But you white people, you don't have a culture. And I think that is a problem, by the way, for anyone who's the sort of dominant member of a society. I mean, in Britain, for example, if you are a white-collar white person, you may not see your culture. Whereas almost everybody else who's something of a minority and a little bit out of power, they do see it a little better than you do. And in order to really preach the gospel in a way that connects to people's questions, you've got to listen to what those questions are. So one, loves the city and talks it up. Two, discourse in the vernacular. Three, you enter and retell the culture story with the gospel. You have just ways of doing that in your preaching and your discourse and so on. Now, four, I'm going to jump. You create Christian community that is countercultural and counterintuitive. Look up here. Don't look down here because I'll take too long if I try to stick with this. Christians' approach to sex needs to be very, very different than outside. Christians' approach to money needs to be very different outside, and Christians' approach to power, sex, money, and power. We've got to be different. In power, Christians ought to be sharing it so that Christian communities ought, as much as possible, be characterized by multi-ethnicity. It just isn't happening out in the rest of society. When the rest of society looks inside and sees Christian churches in which white people are really willing to share power with non-white people, they say, "Wow, that's different." Money. People out there are doing everything they can to make as much money as they possibly can. Inside, we ought to be taking our money and sharing our money in radical ways, giving our money away, being incredibly generous with the money, inside and outside the church. So one of the ways in which we're missional is that the church has got to look, it sounds very weird, does it not? And this is a Leslie Newbegin thing. The best way to have an impact, the best way to contextualize for the community around you is to be different in some ways. In some ways, to be like them. In some ways, to know their cultural narratives, to know the movies, to know the books, to answer the questions that they're asking. To love the city, to discourse in the vernacular. But when it comes to the way in which the people live together, we need to be utterly different. We need to be holy. And real holiness is attractive, actually. Real holiness, power sharing. You know, and by the way, what Christians say about sex in our society is going to look oppressive. And therefore, being different with regard to sex has to go along with being different with regard to money and power. Why? Because what we say about sex is going to look oppressive, because that's the narrative in the secular world, that if you say only you can't have sex outside marriage and only heterosexual sex inside marriage, that's very oppressive. But if we are biblical with our money, if we're as generous and as non-materialistic and as non-consumeristic as the Bible wants us to be with our money, and if we're as willing to share power as the Bible says we ought to, and if we're willing to do a kind of Ephesians 2 thing in which we show that in Christ there's no slave or free, there's no Jew or Greek. What is that? That's race and that's class. Then that's going to contradict the secular, you know, narrative about sex. And therefore, our communities have got to be different, really different. So our discourse in some ways has to be more connected and more like the culture around, but our community life together has to be less like the culture. And lastly, Practice Christian unity. And at the rate I'm going, I think this is almost the end of my talk here. Here's what I mean by practice Christian unity. And this, again, is a Leslie Newbegin insight. Newbegin at some point says, and I think he's totally right about this, he says, 200 or 300 years ago, when everybody in Europe basically was a Christian, the way for a church to define itself was over against other churches. What did it mean to be Presbyterian? Well, it wasn't Anglican. What does it mean to be Protestant? It's not Catholic, right? You know, what does it mean to be Free Church of Scotland? We're not the Church of Scotland. In other words, in a lot of ways, the way you defined yourself was negatively. You defined yourself, we're not like them, okay? So you know what happened to the Presbyterian who was, you know, shipwrecked all by himself on a desert island. He built 3 churches, you know, 1 to go to and 2 not to. Because, you heard that? You know, okay, how could you feel good about your church if there weren't 2 churches you weren't going to? Otherwise, there's no reason to go. And Newbegin is right about the fact that today, because we live in a secular society now, churches ought to define themselves over against the world, not over against each other. Now, what does that mean? It means, on the one hand, the differences between even our networks in here are not insignificant differences. They're not insignificant. Somebody's right and somebody's wrong about several significant biblical issues. And it's important for us to say, I read the Bible and I see it this way and I can't do it the way you do it. And maintain your integrity. But you cannot allow secondary differences to divide us wholly from each other, because showing the world a united front among all, at least, Christians who believe in the authority of the Bible and believe in the gospel and believe in the necessity of the new birth and so on. If the church doesn't at least see unity, if the culture doesn't see at least that kind of unity, then they're right. Their little narrative is Christians are divisive, religion is what's wrong with society, religion just leads to atomization and fragmentation and fighting and division. You know, it led to the religious wars, and they're still having religious wars. Fortunately, they're so small and so isolated, so marginal, they can't literally kill each other anymore, but they used to. We certainly don't want them to grow back to the place where they can actually kill each other. Unless the church, the culture, sees unity, visible unity, as much as we possibly can muster, then we're not missional. Now, see how this works out? Let me finish this way. Case study. This is on page, it's your page, it's different. You see what page? It's on page 7. Okay? Let me show you why this is more than evangelism, and then at this point I'm going to start taking questions. Let me show you how being a missional church goes beyond any program. It's not just doing Alpha or Christianity Explored or something like that, glom it on and now I'm an evangelistic church. Oh my goodness, no. Though, by the way, programs like that can be tremendously beneficial, hugely beneficial. I'm not in any way denigrating them at all. I'm just saying that they're insufficient, that's all. And let me show you what I mean. These elements, I'll just read this. These elements that I've just gone through have to be present in every area of the church. So, for example, what makes a small group, what would make it missional? That you're having outreaches and you're inviting non-Christians to hear the gospel? Yes, yes, do it. But that's not all that I mean. In fact, something more fundamental has to happen. A missional small group is not necessarily one that's doing some kind of specific evangelism, but rather, number one, if its members love and talk positively about the city and their neighborhood. 2, if they speak in a language that is not filled with pious tribal or technical terms and phrases, nor disdainful and embattled language all the time. 3, if in their Bible study they apply the gospel to the core concerns and stories of the people out in the culture, not just their own theological hobby horses. 4, if they are obviously interested in and engaged with the literature and art and thought of the surrounding culture and can discuss it appreciatively yet critically. 5, if they exhibit deep concern for the poor and generosity with their money and purity and respect with regard to opposite sex and show humility toward people of other races and cultures. And 6, if they do not bash other Christians and churches, you know, speaking disdainfully of them, then you're going to find that seekers and non-believing people from the city will end up being invited into that group. They will come and stay as they explore spiritual issues. If these marks are not there, it will only be able to include believers or traditional Christianized people, but not really reach the neighborhood. Before you do all the other things that you tend to do as a, for evangelism for your small group, these missional factors have to be present. And I think I'm going to stop there. If you want to ask me more specific questions about all the other things that I had in the handout, I'll bring them out to you. Please read the whole thing, because in this particular case, I really only covered about a third of the material in the handout. So unless you read the whole handout, you won't get what I was trying to say. I didn't talk too much about what it means to be contextual, how to contextualize specifically for a center city kind of situation, but maybe you can ask. So we have a few minutes to ask questions before we close in prayer with our panelists. But questions?